League's Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning League's Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. League's Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Welcome to the inaugural F1 Racing Podcast. I'm Stuart Codling, and joining me for this epoch-making event, fresh from London's Heathrow Airport, is our columnist and business expert, he doesn't like the word guru, Mark Gallagher.
Pleasure to be here. The inaugural one. It's very exciting.
This is like cracking the champagne.
Good.
On the side of the ship. It has already broken. Yep. Hopefully it'll make its way down the slipway. Also joining us to usher this podcast down the slipway is the magazine's editor, Ben Anderson.
Hello.
You've just flown in from Geneva. Strikes me as a very roundabout way of getting back from Monaco. Do you hate Gatwick Airport that much?
I just like being a jet setter, really. You know, take off from Nice, go to Geneva for a day, come back to London. I do hate Gatwick. Actually, I've noticed it was voted the 123rd worst airport in the world the other day, which I thought was quite a shocking statistic.
That's quite a good result.
122 are the shockers. Yeah, so there's a lot worse. Anyway, yes, Geneva. Weirdly enough, going to visit a big company that used to sponsor Formula One to talk to them about how to improve performance. We're going to come on to that, I think, in a minute, because they were talking very much to me about how do you make a team that isn't doing so well do a lot better.
There are quite a few teams in Formula One that could do with that advice. Now, Ben, thank you very much for allowing me to go to the Monaco Grand Prix, one of the great privileges of the season.
You're welcome, Codders.
You've been here minding the shop. We've actually just received the latest issue of the mag. Unfortunately, it was in the process of being printed when we learned of Niki Lauda's death last week, so we weren't able to include and reflect upon that news in the issue.
Well, there's a short story, isn't there? Short story, just recording said facts. But yes, not enough time to turn around a proper tribute, sadly.
Yes, it's literally holding the press. It's terrible, isn't it, how things like that happen just as you're sending a new issue off and you can't really reflect on something properly. But we do have plans for our next issue and we're assembling them right now. But this is quite a good as time as any to reflect on Niki's life and career. Now, Mark, you've spent 35 years in F1. What are your memories of Niki Lauda?
My first memory of Niki Lauda, the man, was at the British Grand Prix at Brands Hatch in 1984 when I walked up to him and asked him would he autograph one of his books, which I'd recently bought. And he very charmingly did so, which I wasn't expecting because you read things about Niki being a bit serious about the business of Formula One racing. And me turning up as a 22-year-old Autosport employee and asking him for his autograph, I thought he might give me short shrift, but he was very pleasant about it. That was the first time I met him, and then throughout my career I've dealt with him when he was working with German TV. Of course, we as a journalist back in the 80s, of course I covered the tail end of his career, and then of course we saw him dip into management and very quickly back out of management at Jaguar, which was never going to be suited to straight-talking Niki Lauda. And then more recently, you know, everyone involved in Formula One has witnessed the key role that he's played as Toto's partner at Mercedes.
I imagine that straight-talking Niki dealing with the board members of Ford as being kind of the irresistible force meeting the immovable object.
I mean, it was never going to work. And I mean, it's perhaps not surprising that Ford and Jaguar thought Niki would be a good guy to bring in. It's probably quite surprising that Niki said yes to do it. But then I suspect he'd never dealt with that kind of culture before. And so I think it was never going to work because it was far too hierarchical. Everybody reported to Detroit and you had to write long reports to justify your existence every 5 minutes. So that was never going to work. And the thing is, he needed a much more agile kind of business. And it's interesting that, you know, the kind of the success that he achieved with his airlines ultimately has been then reflected in the success that he has achieved with Toto and Mercedes at the team. That sort of built an entrepreneurial style team, which is one of the reasons Mercedes is so damn good. It's not run like a car business, it's run as a racing team.
Yeah. He certainly had a direct connection from brain to mouth, didn't he? And Ben, did you ever encounter that?
Yeah, well, that's every interview with Niki Lauda, isn't it? Post driving career, completely straight talking. One imagines that Ford liked the idea of hiring a straight talking man until they didn't like what he had to say. but yeah, Niki was great figure in the paddock.
But therein, kind of, sorry to interject, but therein is kind of what we're going to talk about when we get on to making bad teams go better. You need straight talking, and Niki can do that. And I think, and it I would love to have been a fly on the wall, during his time at Mercedes-Benz, because I'm sure Toto Wolff has got literally a life of anecdotes to share about those key moments and words and probably blunt conversations he had with Niki down the years. But the ultimate result of it has been extraordinary.
Yeah, actually, one of my favourite Niki Lauda stories isn't even a motor racing one. It's the aftermath of one of his planes crashed, I think because of a problem with the reverse thrust mechanism, and Boeing kind of sloping desked it onto the pilots and said it was pilot error. Niki didn't agree with that verdict. So he said, okay, right, well, I've tried this in a simulator, doesn't work. Why don't you tell you what? Actually, I'm being far too verbose. Niki probably said, "Okay, you come up in the plane. I put reverse thrust on. You'll see what happens."
Yeah.
and Boeing finally kind of took ownership of the problem. But it was only then when Niki Lauda said, "Okay, right, we'll go up in one of my planes and we'll whack the reverse thrusters on."
I don't think
whatever.
Boeing realized what they were dealing with. And, you know, when someone offers to go up in a passenger plane and stick one of the engines in reverse at 30,000 feet to see whether it's recoverable, you know you're dealing with someone who's got a degree of courage that most of us don't have. But we knew about that. And, you know, going back to your first question to me about touching on Niki professionally and whatever, but touching on, for me as a fan, as a 14-year-old, I remember distinctly opening a copy of The Observer color supplement on a Sunday morning and reading the story of the accident, and this was a few weeks later, and being completely spellbound and realizing that, you know, here was someone who appeared to be almost superhuman in his ability to come back. And that's what made that season just so extraordinary. And it is interesting, isn't it? I mean, lots of former racing drivers pass away as they get old, you know, and we've lost people like John Surtees in recent times and so on and so forth. The impact of losing Niki has been quite profound, because it's actually touched several generations. So the older generation, like me, we were fans when he was racing. The much older generation were racing with him. And I think for the younger generation, there's been this understanding of the role he's played in F1 to this very day.
We kind of take it for granted, don't we, that Formula One is a global sport that's watched by millions on TV. But arguably, you can look back at that 1976 season and kind of think that actually it was that caught the imagination of people and made it the global sport that it's become.
Absolutely. I mean, and it's kind of, at the risk of upsetting any James Hunt fans out there, I mean, let's face it, James Hunt won the world championship because Niki Lauda missed some Grand Prix because he was nearly burnt to death in Germany. Otherwise, he'd have been a four times world champion. But that story of the comeback and then of James nicking it in Japan at the last minute because Niki parked the car, quite frankly, it was an extraordinary story. And I think the only shame of Rush, the movie, which many people have seen, is that director Ron Howard decided to add a layer of enmity between James and Niki off track, which actually didn't exist. The story is even the richer for the fact that they could be bitter rivals on track, but mates off it. And that Hunt Lauda thing is, it'll never be forgotten.
I think Niki had quite a lot of input into the screenplay as it eventually turned out, because they had hired him as a consultant. I think he gave the original script short shrift when apparently there was this may be completely anecdotal, but apparently in the original script it describes him getting into his Ferrari F1 car and turning the key, and his reaction was, "This is bullshit."
It sounds about right.
But also he accepted Ron Howard's decision to have this kind of goody baddie story of James and Niki just for you know, Hollywood effect and impact in the American market, so that because the audience would understand that better. But as I said before, I think they lost a richer dimension to that relationship that they had.
Yeah, I thought the tail end of the film, right at the end, packed a real emotional punch. Ben, do you recall watching Rush?
They actually end up being matey at the end of the film, don't they? So they kind of reconcile that element that you were talking about, Mark. Yeah. It's like, oh, actually, no, we're all right. You know, I respect you and you respect me. And
yeah, and it sort of slips into Loud's voice, and they do this in very, very clever piece of editing. You see Louder sort of reflecting on, you know, what might have been for James after he retired, and the way his life went, and then the last image of the film is the real Niki Lauda, not Daniel Brühl, kind of looking older. And, you know, as he was in the present day then, looking older and a bit more reflective. And that was a really, really classy way to end the film, I thought. A very emotional punch.
Other thing about Nicky's passing, and I realise we probably want to move on to other things, but is when you think about Bernie Eccleston as the guy who built modern Formula One into the colossus that it is, these have been a difficult few weeks for him, and watched him doing a little interview at the weekend on an American TV network, and having to explain about the passing of his friend Nicky, and only really coming a couple of months after losing Charlie Whiting, who was so close to him as well. And, you know, so the kind of the passing of the generations, and Nicky's death is, it feels like quite a pivotal moment in terms of the changing of the guard within Formula One.
And it hits home a lot more, I think, because it's good that you mentioned Charlie. They're both current figures as well. Yeah. You know, going back to what you were saying about, yeah, you know, former world champions in the 30s, he was a guy who was off the scene and had been for a long time. But Charlie, obviously, well before his time, was at the race ready to do his normal job. And Nicky would have been in the paddock this season if it weren't for his lung problems hitting him in the middle of last year. So it feels that much more immediate when these are guys you expect to see around and about in Formula One doing their thing even today.
And I don't know about you guys, but I know when in my extended family, I've had WhatsApp messages over the last week from people saying, really sorry to hear about Niki Lauda. And I'm thinking, you know, a lot of them don't even follow Formula One closely, but Niki transcended the sport. And you know, whether it was Rush, but actually I think it was much more to do with just this iconic story about the comeback, which I think so many people heard about over the years.
I suppose let's move from one icon to another, that being Williams. Now, in your column... This
seamless
month, Mark,
segue
this
there, Colors.
Seamless. It's like I've done one of these things before. I haven't been barred from doing the Autosport podcast on account of great galumphing quantities of whimsy.
He's not bitter.
I was reduced to chauffeuring duties in the latest one as they recorded it in the back of the car. Shocking. They didn't even give me a tip. Now, your column this month, Mark, concerned the Williams team. Now, in Monaco, George Russell finished 15th, which really isn't anything to crow about for a championship winning team. But George was actually very animated and positive afterwards. Unfortunately, we can't share the audio with our listeners because it's recorded within the F1 paddock and there are broadcasting restrictions on that, but the quotes are out there. His enthusiasm is pretty obvious. I suppose the question is, where do Williams go from here? You wrote in your column that you may as well try to unbake a cake as kind of go back through the design process, but Williams say that they've got an upgrade coming. The drivers seem to be fairly sort of optimistic about where things are going. Claire Williams said, we never give up on a season in Monaco. So it seems like the team is actually committed to learning about this car and what's gone wrong with it. So question for you guys is that the right thing to do?
Well, they definitely need to figure out where they went wrong, and they've identified the issue that they believe is central to the flaw that's within this car. But when you consider this is the second successive Williams that has really underperformed, there's been something fairly deep going on there that means that they've missed the boat in terms of achieving the levels of competitiveness that they were expecting for these last two seasons. So understanding the problem is one thing. Bringing an upgrade, I mean, let's be clear, there are upgrades and there are fixes. I mean, this is a fix more than an upgrade. It's just they need to get the basics right within that car, and it can't come soon enough. But it is a team with limited resources, and they the question will soon arise as to whether there's any wisdom in them, you know, throwing good money after bad this season. So if that upgrade stroke fix doesn't deliver the step change in performance that they wanted to, it's on to 2020, really.
They're in a very difficult spot because the rules have just changed. So everyone started with this new set, if you like, the big changes to the front wing and everything else that follows. So in order to develop your nascent aerodynamic understanding, you can't really afford to just abandon what you've got, however much of a pig it might be. It's the only pig you've got, and it's going to inform everything you do subsequently. So they kind of have to persist for practical reasons, but against a backdrop of a team with no technical leadership, because clearly the Paddy Lowe promised land never materialised. So they've got that problem to address, and then you've got longer standing problems within the team going back further in terms of how they approach design, how they approach engineering, how they approach everything to do with producing the Formula One car, set against the backdrop of further regulation changes that are coming downstream. And they're stuck in this position of, do we need to scale back to model our team more like a Haas and buy more components off the shelf? But bearing in mind Williams is a team that's steeped in traditional constructing of a Formula One car, or do they hold fire and wait and see and hope that Liberty changes the rules so that actually being a constructor is what you need to be, and therefore actually they can consolidate what they have and maybe even expand on their infrastructure? So they're facing lots of very difficult challenges from kind of all sides, really. And the other thing is, while they're having a poor season or another poor season on track, they've got fewer places to hide, because, you know, it wasn't so long ago there were smaller teams enticed in by the Max Mosley budget cap that never happened, that they could hide behind them effectively. You know, if they had a bad season, they were going to be, yeah, 9th or 10th, but that's not 11th or 12th. Now, as Sergio Perez was saying earlier in the season, there are no bad teams in Formula One. All of them are pretty well-funded, decent operations. So Williams having two bad seasons in a row means they're just way off the back. And even if the team isn't operating too badly compared to the team that did quite well in 2014, 15, even 16 or 17, they just look so bad.
The interesting thing on the operational front is that Monaco, they threw the dice really early with Russell and pitted him under the safety car, and he was so far behind he actually registered as being on the previous lap to the leaders. And they put him on the hard tyres, and that might even have got him into the points if Raikkonen and Norris hadn't started parking the bus. But that's kind of a one-off, really, in a different circumstance. I mean, I suppose if we address the management culture issue, Mark, you said only those inside Grove know where the problems lie. And Paddy Lowe, before his departure or his period of leave, said that there was a problem with there was a culture within Williams, that there was a belief that there were just a couple of problems to solve and then everything was going to be all right, whereas really the culture had to be that everything is up to be challenged. So I suppose the issue here is Williams as a team too set in its ways, and whether that's a yes or no, is bringing Sir Patrick Head back in as a consultant the right thing to do?
Well, Ben just used a word to describe Williams as, you know, words to describe Williams, steeped in tradition. And tradition's great, and heritage is really important in a team like Williams. But if there are traditional ways of doing things that no longer work, you need to question them. And that's, I suspect, what Paddy's referring to. And they should challenge everything. If you insist on making your own gearbox, but it's ultimately not giving you competitive advantage when you have a limited budget, what's the point of making your own gearbox? If you're upset because you would have to let 20 people go, I completely understand that. But that comes down to making tough decisions. And, you know, you mentioned Haas. I'm sure it completely frustrates the heck out of Williams that they employ three times the number of people, but actually they're operating on a not dissimilar budget. And you know, you've got Magnussen charging around Monte Carlo doing an amazing job. And, you know, and this is a relatively new team with basically no sponsors. We'll come on to that in a minute. But you know,
it's the efficiency of the spend, isn't it?
It's the efficiency of the exactly. And I supplied engines to them when I was running Colesworth. Sam Michael was a technical director at that time, and I've worked with Sam way back to Jordan days when he was a race engineer for us. And And even then, I kind of got a sense of, well, not, it wasn't even a sense. People inside Williams told me, we have too many bottlenecks in our business. There are individuals who just want to control decision-making. So we get bottlenecks. We don't get agility. It's a little bit staid from that point of view. I mean, I'm not a professional journalist these days. I write this column for the magazine, and I write the column knowing the individuals. I have a huge amount of respect for the Williams family. I think Claire Williams is a very fine person. The people who work for the Williams family and the other shareholders have not been delivering for them for years. They did finish third in the World Championship under the new regulations, partly due to the strength of the powertrain.
Mainly due to the strength of the powertrain.
Yeah, okay. I'm spreading the love here. I'm spreading the love. And you know, Williams are very keen to remind people it's not so long ago that they were in third in the championship and then fifth in the championship, but they have fallen massively in the last 24 months. And the soul searching needs to be deep and meaningful. And I sincerely hope that they have those Niki Lauda style conversations and people are honest about what they have, the job they've been doing for Williams, and they go out and they find themselves a top level technical leader. They need strong technical leadership in that team of the Adrian Newey style, which is someone who gives a sense of direction to the whole organization, who empowers people to get on with the job, who doesn't interfere and create a bottleneck, but actually just gets a high performing team of the kind that we know is needed to deal with the relentless nature of Formula One. There's just no time to waste.
The cultural changes can be quite difficult to enact in short order. And I feel like the 2021 rules will be the point at which they have to make a decision. So they're going to maybe defer a bit, maybe for fear of upsetting certain people, maybe because it's difficult to let certain departments go. Maybe you might need them again because you don't know which direction it's going in. But at that point, the rules will be set and they'll have to make certain decisions, probably some quite difficult ones. But it's long overdue, isn't it? You were talking about 2014-15 being actually anomalous in fairly recent Williams history. I remember an interview in F1 Racing with Mark Webber looking at his life in pictures. And there was a picture published of him racing in a Williams against Fernando Alonso, both of them coming down to the chicane at Monaco. And Mark was talking about how he could have gone back to Renault and been Alonso's teammate in 2005, I think that was. And he said he got basically his heart ruled his head. He wanted to go to Williams because he remembered Alan Jones racing for Williams, and it was Patrick Head and Frank and all of that history and success in the past. But he said the culture even then wasn't right. It wasn't the same team. They'd already at that stage started to get left behind, if you like. And has that really changed in the intervening 15 years? I mean, they've only really gone in one direction, haven't they, which is backwards. So maybe these problems that we're talking about now aren't so recent. Some of them may go back many, many, many years previous.
On an optimistic note, things will change at Williams. And they will change at Williams for a number of different reasons. They'll change because the current management and shareholders change them and have the blunt conversations that we're talking about, and they'll move in the right direction. Or it will suffer a McLaren-esque crisis, which means that a lot of people will go. There will be new people come in, possibly even new shareholders be invited to come in and invest in the business. And I am optimistic because in Monaco, I spent a couple of hours with two of the shareholders of the Sauber Alfa Romeo racing team and one of their senior advisors. And they explained to me what they had done in the last 2 years to change that team around. Again, great leadership in the form of Frédéric Vasseur being brought in. But you look at Alfa Romeo racing today, you look at the story of the last couple of years, Williams can do that. They can do better than that, you know. And
even McLaren this year, they've had their zero point, haven't they? And they're building back up again, and it's happened fairly quickly. I mean, okay, there was a quick technical fix there regards front wing approach, but nevertheless, those two examples, I think, as you say, they provide an optimistic point of reference
for Claire. And, you know, when Monisha Kaltenborn was ousted from Sauber and she'd been team principal there for a long time and had shareholding in the team, you know, it felt shocking, you know, because she'd been around the paddock. That change had to happen. And it is seismic and it's shocking for the individuals concerned. But organisations grow through different phases. Williams is in a phase at the moment which they need to rebound from. And I believe that will happen. And I really hope it happens with the Williams family remaining the main shareholders, because I think it's great that we have a team with that heritage and with Frank's name still over the door after all of these years. It's wonderful.
Well, they should get some blunt talking from Sir Patrick, because I'm led to believe that he, you know, we know he's an opinionated individual, but apparently he did used to send at least one email a week to Paddy Lowe detailing what he thought, even when he was on the outside. And a couple of years ago, I was at the Williams 40th anniversary thing at Silverstone, and I heard Sir Patrick opining, I think probably... in a tone of voice and a volume that enabled me to hear him over the Renault V10 and the FW14 that Kieran Chandock was demonstrating, him saying, "I've looked at the current Williams and there are so many stupidities on it, it beggars belief." So if he rolls through the technical team like that, that should certainly shake it up a little bit.
I also was in Geneva last week and I flew back with Patrick, who had been at an FIA working group meeting at Geneva Airport. And we had a chat about Williams. And I said, "How's it going with you? You know, you're going in there once a week and having a chat." And the passion has undimmed. You know, Patrick Head is as passionate today as he ever was about Williams, about Frank, about helping the team. I mean, he said to me, "Well, you know what I'm like." He said, I shouted quite a few people when I'm there, but he said I just want the team to move forward. And this is why I say I'm optimistic, because I think ultimately the conversations, whether it's today or tomorrow or next month or next year, eventually there will be the right decisions made, because the alternative is more of the same. And if there's more of the same, there's no one associated with that team in the leadership or shareholders who wants another season like this. So changes will be made. Yeah.
At the opposite end of the grid, but with similar levels of passion, we've got Ferrari, and Ferrari are the cover stars of our current issue in the form of Mattia Binotto. Scott Mitchell's written a very good feature looking at Mattia and the impact he's made on the team. I suppose what we kind of have to ask is, given that they still seem to be struggling operationally, what, and also in terms of the technical concept of the car, is it right, is it not? Binotto seems to have done well in his role of moving up to be team principal. He's not the first person to go from tech director to team principal. Question is, who's manning the shop and what more do they have to do to actually develop the strength and depth to challenge Mercedes?
It's extraordinary, isn't it? You know, here's the team that was quickest in pre-season testing and everyone went, "So, oh, this is going to be great. It's going to be a real genuine two-car battle." They're now admitting the concept has probably taken them up a blind alley. There isn't a lot they can do with the sort of low drag route that they've taken. But again, coming back to human factors, it's a team that seems to freeze under pressure, and they get very bound up with one mistake leading to another. Monte Carlo was just... It was extraordinary to watch Ferrari's weekend come apart, and pretty basic things, whether it's, you know, Leclerc missing the weighbridge, whether it's sitting in the pits watching Vettel put him out in qualifying. You know, these are pretty fundamental things, and it begs the question, are people frozen to say the obvious? You know, like, we need to get that car back out. Doesn't matter what the computer says. Doesn't matter whether we think we've got 3/10 in hand or not. We need to put in another lap. Because when you're trying to challenge for the championship, or supposed to be, you can't leave any stone unturned and you can't be complacent about your competitiveness.
I think they're just a bit stuck in almost a death spiral this season. I think the key...
A
death spiral for their championship hopes, which is a real shame. I mean, yeah. Our cover is a call to arms, really. Formula One needs Ferrari to be competitive, because otherwise it's going to be a Mercedes silver wash, isn't it? They're going to dominate the championship like they did in 2014-16, and that isn't the spectacle that we all as fans and everyone in F1 really wants to see. It seems like they've gone in one direction, focusing more on aerodynamic efficiency. I think they wanted a you know, a car that was less draggy than perhaps their previous ones, figuring, I guess, that the rules were going in that way and stripping the cars of overall downforce, so it would be quite sensible to just go to run with that, if you like, and see where you could get. But in tandem with those rule changes, you've got the tyre compounds, as ever, shifting slightly, and it seems that they haven't really got quite the right downforce level to get the tyres working properly. There've been changes to other rules regarding the tyres, the blanket temperatures have been reduced, so suddenly all your tyre science, which you've spent seasons building up, goes out the window slightly. And I just think they can't quite get that car into the right space with the tyres consistently enough. When they do, as they did in pre-season, as they did in Bahrain, as they did until the temperatures dropped in qualifying in Baku, that car is extraordinarily fast, it almost on a different level to anything else in the field, accepting the fact that Mercedes are improving constantly as they do. But when they can't get that formula right, then it falls massively out. They've got a car that's really peaky, a bit like the Mercedes of the past two seasons. And Ferrari had the car that was, you know, malleable, and you could just stick it on the track in any condition, it would be competitive. Now it seems like that's what the Mercedes is. But given Ferrari have got started the season in that position, you're always then chasing your tail, aren't you? You're always having to try and do things to work out, well, can we actually make this concept work in more conditions, at more temperature ranges? Do we persist? Do we persist? But then you have points lost in certain races. You have some races where you're not even competitive enough. You have some races where an unfortunate freak reliability failure robs you of a great result.
Do you not think that if they had a Bahrain victory, would have totally changed everything, wouldn't it?
I mean, it's a Bahrain and a Baku victory.
Exactly.
They could have easily won two of the first four races, and then suddenly you're talking about a championship with Leclerc, okay, not the driver you expected necessarily to be at the forefront, which is another problem they've had to deal with unexpectedly. You know, he'd be in the championship fight, and you'd be thinking, well, actually, they've done pretty well in two out of four races, or two out of six it would be now, of course, but you know, Vettel had a pretty good go at Monaco, and if things had been slightly different, Leclerc might have been a factor for pole.
The pressure washes away when you win a race.
Yeah.
Yeah, would they have taken as many risks if they'd won those two races?
It's exactly what Binotto was saying, wasn't it? He was saying, in our position, we're so many points behind, we have to take more risks to try and catch up. And that is the kind of strategy that either pays for you really well. If Leclerc had got pole and had an extra set of tyres to play with, then you'd just say, oh, brilliant Ferrari, you know, sneak him through Q1 and, you know, they've gone on to win the race. As it was an embarrassment, and Leclerc was nowhere in his home Grand Prix. If they'd won those races early in the year, they wouldn't be taking those risks, certainly. So it's interesting because Scott's feature argues well that Binotto is the right man. He's the guy that Ferrari have been missing. And if you think about the way they've been dealing with all of these headaches, and there have been many of them, you know, he's very calm, he's very forthright, he's come out in this spirit of openness, he's been straight talking. I think he doesn't duck the problems, he doesn't duck the questions. We've been talking throughout this podcast about having the right culture of how you approach things. The test of that is when things go wrong, not when they go right, and they are going wrong pretty consistently for Ferrari at the moment. It seems to me like Binotto is handling it well, so maybe this season isn't going to be the one where they get the job done, but with the right attitude, they've got some ingredients there to be potentially a real force under these regulations. So tidying up the loose edges, or the rough edges, should I say, they could be really strong next season.
I completely agree with you. And I think, you know, if you look back to this time last year, Max Verstappen had been through a torrid start to the season, trying too hard, overdriving the car, everything that could go wrong was going wrong. People were saying he's lost the plot.
Yeah, we threw away Monaco victory, didn't he, by crashing in practice needlessly.
And here we are this year, you know, coming into Monaco. He was third in the championship in front of both the Ferraris.
And, almost won the race, and he's driver of the season, isn't he?
And he's settled down. Ferrari will settle down, and I think they'll get past it. We all have to hope that given the nature of Montreal, that if they have a collective deep intake of breath, you know, reconstitute themselves, keep calm, go into Canada, could be the beginning of the recovery.
Well, as Murray Walker once said, Formula 1 of F1 is if spelled backwards. We, of course, look at that and say, no, Murray, it's actually 1F spelled backwards. But there you go. A memorable phrase.
You can't quibble with the greats.
You can't quibble with the greats. Now, in moving seamlessly on, as we do, in the new section this month, we lead on the return of the Dutch Grand Prix. And Vietnam's also on the calendar next year. And Chase Carey, the CEO of Formula One Management, F1, as FWONK as they're known on the American Stock Exchange, has told investors that he expects the calendar to remain at 21 races. So something's got to give. And as an adjunct to that, they're pretty useful, these investor calls, aren't they, for us to find out what's going on. In the Bernie days, you didn't know what with the smoke and mirrors.
Well, again, that's something else that you know, we were talking about Williams earlier on the podcast. You know, Williams, because they have publicly listed shares, they have to go public with how they're doing financially a couple of times a year. Equally, Liberty have to keep their investors updated with what's happening. And I sometimes get involved in calls with some of the analysts in New York and places who want to know whether what Liberty is saying is true. You know, does it all stack up? Are they really, have they got the right sense of direction in what they're doing? And, I mean, Vietnam looks interesting. David Coulthard, who I do a lot of work with, he's been out there a couple of times doing track demonstrations in the Red Bull demo car. The return of Holland, the Dutch Grand Prix, we all know that's driven by Verstappen. And then there's a couple of big Dutch sponsors who are very happy to come in on the back of that. But it does, again, just emphasize the fact that there's a constant shift going on with countries on the ebb and flow of Formula One events, and stability seems to be difficult, particularly just at the moment. There are a number of promoter contracts. I think there are 5 contracts up for renew this year, and so quite a few question marks, including over traditional venues, and that is a worry because Vietnam. I mean, let's be clear: the Vietnamese public are not demanding that Formula One comes to the country. That's a government decision, because they want to basically put Vietnam on the sporting global map. Fans in other countries will be very disappointed if they are losing their races.
Yeah, it's going to be difficult in the short term for Liberty to achieve this 25 race calendar that they've talked about in the past. Ross Brawn disagrees. He thinks 25 races is fine.
You'd have to clone me, wouldn't you?
I saw in the paddock at Silverstone last year, after that run of 3 races back to back, on the back of obviously the first half of the season and the early flyaways, people looking a bit broken.
They were very broken.
And Cyril Abitbol made the point that, you know, Formula One is meant to be a place where everyone wants to be. You know, as people working in it, you're selling a glamorous show that everyone wants to be a part of. And if you've got people going around who are knackered, don't want to be there, that many races is too many, it should be fewer so that you make more of each one and people enjoy it more. Liberty seem minded to go in the other direction. But as you say, Mark, the landscape is constantly shifting, and it looks like we get, you know, a government-backed race coming in the shape of Vietnam, but we lose potentially a government-backed race in the shape of Mexico. That kind of model, you're always at the, you know, the behest of shifting political necessities. We're going to, you know, see the return of the Dutch Grand Prix on the back of Verstappen mega story, the growing fan base, but potentially lose the Spanish Grand Prix because Alonso is no longer around. And with that race up for renewal, you know, they obviously want, I guess, to be still part of the show, but it's a much more difficult sell, isn't it? So I don't know if they will be able to achieve ultimately where they want to get to, because you keep hearing talk of a second or third US race, but then those plans hit the skids. It's a very volatile market.
Yeah, and I think I've always felt when I hear the 25 number, I think, well, if they want to have 25 races, it cannot be a 3-day race weekend. You'll have to really just compress it into a 2-day blitz. And I don't think many of the people at the top of F1 fully appreciate the impact on the race team personnel. I really don't think, because they haven't lived it and breathed it. And we've just been talking earlier on about
that's why I was surprised about Ross's comments, actually.
Well, this,
he kind of,
I can tell you, it's one thing to turn up on a Thursday morning with the team principal and fly out on Sunday 2 hours after the race and be home in time for dinner, which, you know, I used to fly to races with Eddie Jordan, and, you know, we'd be home on a Sunday evening ready to watch the highlights. Meanwhile, the boys and girls in the team are still breaking the garage down, driving the trucks home, and these days flying from wherever they are in the world in economy. It's funny you mentioned the triple header, because, again, in Monaco, I was talking with a group of people from a team, and two of them mentioned the triple header and said, you know, whoever thinks that's doable, they need to think again.
There's no break, is there, for the rank and file? That's the problem. It's
and it's a rank and file who deliver Formula One.
Absolutely. Yeah.
You know, Formula One is not delivered by the board members. It's delivered by the rank and file, including their own employees within Formula One group, who have to set up and pull down the paddock club and do all the other things which are involved.
And the fans too. And certainly one of the trickier events to access last season was the reborn French Grand Prix, which came back to Canada. Paul Ricard, beautiful circuit, a little bit of a swine to get to as it happened because of the roads. The promoters have taken note of what happened. They plan to address the shortcomings of last year. They've brought in former McLaren racing director Eric Boullier to join the management team. I spoke to him at the French Grand Prix roadshow in Nice last month to find out what's going to be different this year. And because we didn't record it inside the F1 paddock, we can actually share the audio of that interview now.
Well, first of all, yes, this is great to be here in Nice. And as we are talking, you can see the amount of people coming to the roadshow, which is quite amazing. We expect something like 50,000 people today, which is a massive, massive attendance for just an event, one of the events. Transitionally, yes, a lot of different changes. But I've been racing all my life. As far as I remember, when I started racing, I was 9 years old. So you can expect, obviously, me having a different hats or caps over the years. Yes, it's a different job from being a F1 team boss or being involved in a Grand Prix organization, but you still have the same challenges. You know, first you have to manage a lot of people. The week of the Grand Prix, we have 1,000 people working for us. And obviously, as long as the team are also, you know, constrained to respect the timing of the Grand Prix, and we also have to be ready on time, make the track ready on time, and make all the shows, the event, ready on time. So in some ways, there is some similarities. And it's good to also being on the other side of the fence, having an opinion and a view from what team drivers expect. Being on the other side, where you're now in the transition between the fans, TVs, Liberty, FIA, and the teams, so which is also a challenge.
Now, obviously, you've got massive experience attending Grand Prix as a professional, as a team manager, etc. So you knew what you wanted from that point of view. How many times have you actually been to a race as a fan? You know, was that something you did before you got into motor racing? Did you do it while you were involved in motor racing? Or were your weekends off sacrosanct?
Yes, I did. I did. Visited many, many racing events on my own. Before I started Formula One, while I was in Formula One, a little bit less, but I still did it. I did a few occasions. It's true that coming into the French Grand Prix organization, the first thing we did was a sort of debrief, you know, and I could share my experience having traveled for 10 years all over the globe, and I've seen as well the evolution of the Grand Prix model. You know, the historical Grand Prix, like we call them, where you have a lot of people coming, they see the racing. Is actually the model is changing a little bit, and it's mainly due to the newcomers, the flyaway races that we call them. To attract fans from Europe, they build a F1 experience over the weekend, which is not only racing, but you have a lot of things around the F1 track. And I think this is a tendency where we have to go now. That's why actually we have just announced a lot of concerts, using any opportunities to make this weekend a good value for money, a good return for the fans. And that's something I shared with the French Grand Prix organization when I joined, saying this is a tendency, this is where I think also Liberty is taking Formula One to be, not only a race series, but an F1 experience all around Grand Prix, obviously.
For the French Grand Prix, one of the big challenges, of course, is the location of the circuit makes it difficult to get it in and out. So if you lay on plenty of entertainment, that must help that situation, because you've given people an incentive to stay for longer, haven't you? To get there earlier, stay longer, leave later.
It's exactly, in fact, is not suiting the strategy. You know, I mean, it's obviously, well, like I said, you know, you look at the evolution of the Grand Prix in the last 10 years or even 15 years, any promoter has to change his model. And it's true that in our case, keeping people on track, not commuting all the time, every morning or every evening, gonna help mobility. Obviously a sensitive issue, but I think as well the job we've done obviously last year was one of, if not the problem, because the rest of the weekend I think was quite a success. We have been working a lot, you know, using latest technology from expert companies to try to understand how to model the traffic and to have a better traffic plan. So I remember a lot of tracks, you know, have the same problem, and from your country first, Silverstone, obviously. Yeah. It took a few years to fix it, but I remember as well Magnico in France, you know, was a mess, you know, and actually they found some solutions by the latest editions, but I think with what we've done, we use the skill and the expertise of these companies who are experts in designing this kind of road and traffic flow. We also obviously did all the tricks, you know, which is to try to limit the number of cars coming and commuting, which should ease the traffic. So we have these two big car park now located at 40 minutes bus drive from the track with a guaranteed actually timing. Because they are using special lanes, so the buses are leaving I think every 2 minutes, so it's better to park there, then you're guaranteed 40 minutes between you from your car to the track, which is not much at the end when you think about trying to park closer, walking to the track. So at the end it's similar, even better. And then all the kind of things we just announced as well, a partnership with Waze, the applications, the famous mobile application. They will design a team and a special traffic, you know, messaging around the area, so everybody can download it for free, everybody can use Waze for free, and will help with where to go and how to do. And obviously, the traffic plan first has been completely redesigned. You know, if you come from Marseille, you don't need to park on the east side of the track and have to cross all the traffic. Everything has been designed to be much, much easier to come in and get out. I think in the end, we multiply by 3 the capacity in terms of flow rate, coming in, coming out.
It's always a learning experience, isn't it? What about encouraging people to stay near the track? There seem to be a lot of campsites and that sort of thing. Or is camping still sort of the preserve of the hardcore? I don't know. Have you ever camped at a motor race? Have you stayed in motorhomes?
Yeah, obviously a long time ago. But when I started, I was sleeping in the truck, so I was like sort of camping. I think it's going to be one of the key parts as well of the development of this F1 experience is to be able to have enough sized campsite to attract, you know, fans to come, because this is easier. They come on Thursday or Wednesday and they enjoy the weekend until Monday or Sunday night, you know. And I think having all these events every day, so all the day long from 9 o'clock to basically 7, is going to be non-stop on the track, around the track. And then in the evening you have another show starting with music, concert. And I think you can keep people, or every kind of people, happy for all the day, you know.
30 or 40 years ago, there was a big debate about televising sports events, and race promoters in Formula One in the 1970s, early 80s, tended to not like the idea of having their races televised because they thought that provided a disincentive for people to actually attend. Do you think that happens nowadays, or is it something you're aware of in terms of putting on events, or is it just the case of when you construct your event with all these extra things happening around the race, you're just, you know, just making something that's almost like a holiday, so the TV thing is irrelevant?
It's not irrelevant. You need to live with your I don't know, you say in English, but you need to live with your time, you know. The way people are consuming now sports events is very different from that time. I understand the concern of the promoters at that time, and we might have in some ways the same today, where we have to adjust the format of the race weekend to make it more attractive for people to live it live and to have enough to live during the event to get the emotions that you have to be there. You can't live this from through your application on your phone or through a TV. I think today we all see If you have time, you sit down and watch the race. If you don't have time, you just check on your application, the results, or you want to see some highlights of the race because you can't be sitting in behind your TV. But the truth is, obviously, yes, you need to make it attractive enough to make people coming. And that's maybe a change, or let's say the new evolution of the model we started 30 years ago with the arrival of the TV.
It's quite race dependent as well, isn't it? For instance, when the Chinese Grand Prix first started, I remember they struggled to get people in. There were more people standing outside trying to sell you fake watches than there were actually in the track having bought tickets, whereas now they seem to have built something. In France, you don't really have that problem, do you? Because people wanted a Grand Prix, so you know, you've kind of given it to them.
Yeah, we were surprised last year, you know, to have such obviously interest, you know, and actually the attendance of the Grand Prix was very much French people, French local people, let's say. Obviously, consequences was we were not ready or prepared for such a traffic, high traffic attendance on Friday, and that created the story we know. And obviously, the second edition will be a challenge, but we also need to build up on a long-term and perine, you know, business model. So there will be more commercialization for foreign years, England or Benelux or Germany or some of the countries, you know, to try to be attractive as well for them to fly over and to benefit from this French Riviera experience. We are gonna make sure, you know, we bring as well some of the famous Saint-Tropez beach club inside the paddock, so that's gonna be a proper French Riviera experience. But I can't say more than this.
It sounds fantastic, and also,
but like you said, you know, it's maybe easier to sell, but you still have to sell it, okay? And most important is to design the product to fit the right business model. We are lucky enough to be last weekend of June, which is the beginning of the holidays. Like I said, if you want to experience 4 days of French Riviera experience, you can at an affordable price and leaving the Grand Prix, you know. Then you can spend your holidays whatever you want, but I think it's a good entertainment, you know, to prepare your holiday or to pre-leave your holidays. Yeah.
Well, it's not summer yet here in Nice, but the sun is shining on your endeavours.
Well, it's like I said, the French Riviera is famous for many things, but first is weather. So it's not summer yet, but you have 20 degrees, a lot of sunny days in the year, and the roadshow is here, which is obviously starting his now campaign, coming from the north, starting his campaign now through the road of the south of France, and it's quite amazing when you see the amount of people who come and are still fan of Formula One, you know. I was not expecting this, you know. I did the first one in Disneyland, you know, and people were there for the Formula One stuff. A lot of people came asking selfies or autographs, but they had stories and they were still, you know, eager, you know, to get close to F1. And it's amazing how powerful is Formula One, you know, still even in France.
Especially with the V8 engine car that we're going to be running up and down the Promenade des Anglais later on.
Yeah, and especially this car, because this car was my Lotus car when we won in Abu Dhabi with Kimi. So special relationship with the car. Still the boys I was leading are still working there, you know. So it's still funny to get in and being called boss.
Well, you rather like Kimi, you knew what you were doing.
So a bigger and better French Grand Prix is in the offing, and you can buy tickets at motorsportlive.com. We also caught up with Dan Ricciardo at the French Grand Prix Roadshow for a feature that will run in next month's F1 racing. We'll share the audio with that with you as well then. So moving back to this month's issue, my column at the back of the magazine takes aim at Liberty Media's chums with everyone policy, which seems to be what's causing the 2021 rulemaking process to stall. In Monaco, Claire Williams said that Formula One is far too democratic at the moment, and that the teams have got too much of a say, and that the FIA and F1 should take more ownership of the regulations. That's a brilliant quote, and I'm going to use them in what we call the Bananarama 12-inch extended remix of my column that goes on Autosport Plus. Obviously, it's important to give the teams a voice, but how big a say should they have?
Really interesting that you're quoting Claire Williams as saying that, because if I was Claire, I'd be complaining about the fact that the biggest, most successful teams really do have such a sway over decision making. And so a team like Williams, which would like to have a greater share of the revenue, which would like to see costs come down, which would like to see the constructor status instated in a fair way, because as we talked about Haas earlier on, I think Williams don't really appreciate what's been allowed to happen there, and probably quite rightly so. So I completely understand where Claire's coming from on that. And I do agree that if you keep asking the poachers what they would like, it'll be a
more elephants.
Exactly. Yeah. You know, so it's just a question of someone needs to say this is what's happening. And you know what? If people don't want to do Formula One, they can go away. If Liberty and the FIA turned around and said, right, guys, you're not allowed to spend more than $200 million a year, and we're going to audit this, we're going to have shared technology across sort of certain commoditized items, and what's anyone going to do about it? I mean, the fact is, you get repeated, you know, we're going to quit Formula One from Ferrari, you get we're going to quit Formula One from Red Bull, you get people will always threaten to quit. They just need their bluff to be called, because frankly, the sport will continue. And there are plenty of people out there who would replace them, given half the chance.
That's the absolute key, isn't it?
Being able to say, bye then.
It's calling the bluff. Claire's described the Ferrari rules veto as silly, I think, over the course of the Grand Prix weekend. So, you know, the skirmishes in this proxy war about rules continue, the deadlines roll back. I think the sticky position Liberty have got this time is the renegotiation of the commercial terms in conjunction with the technical regulations, because it's all very well to say, right, we want to do this with the technical regs, like it or lump it, knowing that the teams are signed up for another 5 years, so they, if you want to give them less say, they can't really do anything about it because they're locked in. In this instance, everything's up for grabs. So suddenly your big players, and you mentioned them all, Ferrari, Red Bull, Mercedes, Liberty will be looking at that thinking, have we got a show without those teams? If we take them at their word, we've got to do deals with them, and we've got to then get everyone to sign up to the rules. I think it's very difficult to do both at the same time and make the kind of radical changes they were talking about when they first came in. I think now they've hit that wall of hard reality, which says, well, if we change too much and annoy our key stakeholders, we could realistically lose them because they're not signed up. So how do we do this without upsetting anyone?
They should watch their own Netflix documentary in which the two top teams didn't feature, and it was brilliant. And the simple fact is, if you took them away, it would be brilliant, because the midfield would be scrapping for multiple victories, and everyone would be saying, wow, Alfa Romeo just won a race, or, you know, McLaren are back at the front again. It would be so yesterday's news if any of those top teams quit Formula One.
And if all of Italy switch off because there's no Ferrari, can you afford to take that hit? If Lewis Hamilton doesn't race in Formula One anymore because Mercedes pull out.
But it won't happen. This is the thing, it won't happen. Ferrari will not pull out of Formula One. They will complain about it. They will make a lot of noise. They might even, you know, stage a strike or whatever and not turn up, you know, for a race or something, and protest at what was happening. But the reality is that here is a company publicly listed. Its global marketing is Formula One. If Ferrari pulled out of Formula One, it would be a bigger problem for Ferrari than it would be from Formula One. And let's face it, we've all got a little bit of Ferrari fan within us. I mean, I like Ferrari. You can't not like Ferrari. We're all passionate about them. But we also don't like them holding our sport to ransom. And it's a simple fact that this sport is bigger than any individual team, and that's the way it should be.
Not according to Ferrari.
But therein is the problem, and someone needs to break that. And it's, you know, they've been looked after extremely well for a very long time, and quite rightly, and they've got heritage and tradition and all the things we talked about earlier on, and that should be respected. But they should not be able to hold, you know, a big Ferrari gun to the head of Formula One and perpetuate the kind of unequal balance that is actually really quite destructive to this sport at the moment.
So ultimately, I suppose we're in agreement with Claire Williams here, aren't we? That not necessarily a case of someone who needed to crack heads, but the democracy doesn't really work and the FIA and F1 need to take
that's what Bernie always, that's what Bernie always said. The sport needs a dictator. We used to have a dictator under Bernie. In the end, he became too democratic. He used to say that towards the end of his career. I've allowed it to become too democratic. And, you know, it's kind of an unpalatable truth in some ways.
It was pretty much the argument in your column, isn't it, Codders, that you know, the early days of Liberty's ownership have been the chumocracy, friends with everybody, trying to bring everyone on the side, but we're going to do this, we're going to do that, we're going to do the other to revolutionise Formula One and make it better. But now their ideals are butting up against their relationship with everyone, and they're realising that everyone in Formula One, because of the nature of it, is in it for themselves and are looking to protect their own interests. So ultimately, they have to set the course and accept any potential negative consequences that may come with that.
Yeah, you can't please all the people all the time, as I believe the author of that column said. Hopefully this podcast has pleased some people enough to listen to it again when we do another one.
And I think, by the next issue of F1 Racing, and of course, today.
We will come to that very presently. I think it is time to bring down the curtain on this champagne cracking upon the whole F1 Racing podcast. We'll be doing more, hopefully with our guests here. Mark Gallagher, thank you very much, Mark.
Thank you very much, it's been a pleasure.
Ben Anderson.
Thank you very much, always a pleasure, Codders.
It has been marvellous. Let us know what you'd like us to talk about in future editions of the F1 Racing podcast via letters at f1racing.com.
Are we going to run this like a democracy?
We're going to run it like a chumocracy. Actually, no, I'm going to be the dictator here and decide what goes on. This, in the words of the day-to-day, this is my bureau de change. Now, the latest issue of F1 Racing is on sale now at all good news agents. Digital versions are also available, and you can visit our website, f1racing.com, for some fantastic subscription offers. And indeed, if you're in the UK, you can claim a free gift when you subscribe, which is currently the Brabham BT52 Owner's Workshop Manual, published by Haynes. Brilliant read, even if our editor-in-chief who wrote it says so himself. So that's a free book and a saving of up to 52% on the cover price if you visit autosportmedia.com/offer/F1R19FD. That's autosportmedia.com/offer/F1R19FD. Thank you for listening.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.